Okay, I want to talk about the results from the Cosmic Background Imager, which has been operating since January of 2000 in Chile, at the same site as the site that the ALMA array is going to. And so the altitude is just over 5,000 meters. This is a composite because it's not possible to really get an impression of both the site and the instrument at the same time. This is a large collaboration, as I think most of you know. Most of the work of designing, building the telescope and so on was carried out by this group at Caltech. Steve Payden is the project scientist who's the instrumental genius behind the CBI. He did most of the detailed design of the receivers, the correlator, etc. But we got a lot of help from various collaborators. Particularly, we're now working closely with Steve Myers has played a key role in developing the software, the data pipeline, and extracting the spectrum. Brian Mason has now moved to NRAO. Bill Holtzopfer came and spent 10 months at Caltech checking out the correlator and making some key modifications to the correlator. And we're working closely with Dick Bond's group at CETA, who have played a key role in the data analysis. And of course, we've also got a lot of help from collaborators at the University of Chile and other people, including Bill was at Chicago at the time, but other people at Chicago. It's sited just south of the Bolivian border. We're only about 10 miles from the Bolivian border and 20 miles from the Argentinian border. And it is actually a very good site. And I just wanted to thank our hosts for holding this conference. There was a workshop here at what was then the ITP, now the Kavli ITP, back in 1995, when we finalized some of the critical design considerations and choice of fields and that sort of thing. And then Steve Myers was here in 2000, and he did a lot of the development of the software for the data analysis pipeline. And now we're very fortunate in that Fred Kavli has generously funded the upgrade of the CBI to polarization capability. And Steve is going to be talking about that a little bit at the end of my talk. Here's Steve Myers, who was visiting us when we had a very large windstorm. Steve Payden and John Sievers, who's going to be talking tomorrow. And we were just actually doing fixing up some minor damage on the dome as a result of this windstorm. It's not without hazards. Working up in the driest desert in the world has an amazing amount of snow. And it has now snowed every month of the year at this site at a significant level. And so we do actually, as you saw from my previous slide here, the asterisks are for students, and students have played an absolutely key role in many aspects of this project. So John Cartwright and John Sievers, after we just dug out of a particularly large snowdrift here, digging trucks out of snow at 17,000 feet is breathtaking. And there are other local hazards as well. There was a large bang one afternoon when Brian Mason and Tim Pearson were observing, and they rushed outside to see that a nearby volcano had just erupted. And so it is pretty exciting. So why do interferometry? Well, all instruments have their pros and cons, and the things that are really good about interferometry is you can really do very high precision measurements in terms of both getting the flux density scale very accurately, so you know the intensity scale very accurately, and also you can measure the beam size and beam shape very well indeed. And so that's a real advantage to interferometry, and the CBI is fortunately large enough that we can actually calibrate on a variety of astronomical sources, planets, supernova remnants, radio galaxies, and quasars, all of which we use to cross-check. So we're pretty confident in our intensity scale. The specifications for the CBI are that there are 13 90-centimeter antennas. We operate in 10 1 gigahertz channels from 26 to 36 gigahertz. So that means there are 78 baselines for 13 antennas, of course, and 780 baseline channels. and the baselines go from 1 meter to 5.5 meters in length. Our system temperature is about 30 Kelvin, but we think with new devices that are now being developed at NREO based on a new TRW chip, we should be able to bring this down to closer to 20. So that's a significant improvement that we have that we're planning. There are three rotation axes. You can rotate the instrument. It has an altazimuth mount. So you can point in elevation and then azimuth to pick out a particular field in the sky, but then you can also rotate the telescope about the optical axis, which is very useful for doing all sorts of tests of the system, but also for doing polarization measurements. And just to compare it with other instruments, those shown in italics are those that have not yet either got any data or released the results of any data. Those in regular print are the projects that have produced data, and of course you're all very familiar with the really exquisite results from Boomerang, Maxima, and DAISY, and more recently, of course, the VSA has produced very beautiful results out to an L of about 1,000. And the cosmic background imager does go up to 3,500. This particular representation is a little bit unfair in the sense that it doesn't show you that these experiments down here have much higher resolution in L, and so they map these low acoustic peaks beautifully. Since we have the higher resolution with the CBI, we're actually going, our highest resolution is 3 arc minutes, and so we're probing these angular scales from 3 arc minutes up to a few degrees, actually. And this, if you then look at the actual mass that's contained within a sphere of that diameter at the redshift of last scattering, the masses are shown on the vertical axis here. And so one of the nice things about the CBI is that it is actually probing the mass scales from actually only about an order of magnitude above the scale of the local group right out to the largest superclusters. And so the features that we're seeing in the CBI maps are actually things that would, they are the seeds that gave rise to clusters of galaxies. And so here's a CBI mosaic map, and this the hotspots here are those which indicate the higher density regions. And just to follow on, Bill's talk was a very nice introduction as to why you would want to go to higher multiples. And just to make a couple of points, of course we've seen the first acoustic peak beautifully delineated by Boomerang, Maxima, and DAISY, and the VSA, and we're not very sensitive to this peak, but of course you don't have to measure the first peak in order to be able to measure the geometry of the universe. If you go to an open universe, omega total of 0.4 in the energy density, then of course the features move out to smaller angular scales, and you, in fact, if you're observing out in this region here, of course you can measure the geometry very well, but looking at the other acoustic peaks. And in fact, what we see, as you'll see in the CBI data, is this very sharp dip between the third and fourth peak, which actually gives us a measure of the geometry, which is independent of the position of the first peak. And then another point that Bill alluded to was ability to measure the actual slope of the primordial fluctuation spectrum, and I've just shown it here for three different slopes, but you can see immediately that if you've got data out here, this is all tied to the COBE normalization, you've got a very good measurement of that primordial fluctuation slope. Our strategy was to have two types of observation. One was observe deep fields in order to go to high L, and then the other was to do mosaics in order to give us higher resolution in L. And we had to worry about point sources, quasars and radio galaxies, with this angular resolution. So we did monitor the brightest sources in the field with the 40-meter telescope. And this actually shows you, sorry, let me go back to that. That shows you the original image of one of our mosaic fields, and then the image with the point sources subtracted out as measured with the 40-meter telescope. Okay, now, in fact, it turned out that was a useful check, but we ultimately decided to adopt the same approach as the DAISY people, which was that we basically just used a constraint matrix using the position of all the sources in the NVSS survey in order to project out the point sources. And so That works very well, but in fact you're projecting out quite a lot of your data. And we are going to go back in next year when we'll have a receiver on the Green Bank Telescope. We're building this with the NRAO right now, and actually measure the fluxes of all the sources in our fields, and then we will know which 20% of the sources are those that are actually bothering us, and we'll only project those out, so we'll regain a lot of our data. So in fact, our data, from the data we've already got, will improve significantly once we have that. Well, the technique that we're using is a standard technique, maximum likelihood technique. I won't talk much more about that. Here are the results from the deep field observations, and I just want to show you this to give you some idea of once we have projected out the sources, there are still fainter sources that are not in the NVSS catalog, but we don't know the details of those sources except statistically. But it's a very small correction, and this shows you the level of the statistical faint source correction, and then the stars show you the noise level from our deep field observations. So these are this is the deep field spectrum, and as Bill mentioned, we're seeing an excess of power at high L. We don't know what that is due to at the moment, and we're confident that it's not just an instrumental thing, although it's only about a 3 sigma excess, so you have to treat it in the same way that you treat normal 3 sigma results, or results that are about 3 sigma. Jonathan Sievers will be talking about this excess tomorrow. And it's possible an interpretation as secondary anisotropy due to SZE. Okay, so this is the spectrum that Bill showed earlier, which is a composite of the pre-existing results from boomerang, Dazier, and maxima. Sorry, the maxima results are rather faint. I'll have to change that because you can't see them very well. But I haven't put the VSA on here yet. But basically, you can see that the agreement in the overlap region is really very good, and then of course we extend the results out to much higher L, and we see for the first time the damping tail and all the arguments that Bill gave you for the damping tail. The reasons why you want to measure this are of course very important, because it's an independent, it provides an independent measure of many of the important cosmological parameters. And we did do the test of throwing away the data at low L and looking at the cosmology we got just from the high L results. And the agreement is really very good. And so these do amount then to an independent test. It would be very strange if nature had somehow corrupted the spectrum down here in such a way as to mislead you in the interpretation of maxima, boomerang, and Dazier. And give you one set of cosmological parameters, and had similarly corrupted the data up here in such a way that you would be misled again and derive the same incorrect set of cosmological parameters. That would seem to be extremely mischievous, and so we think this is important to get the results at a different L range. And finally, I just want to show you the best-fitting curve, which is the red curve as to the CBI data alone, without any other information at all. And then the black curve is when you put all of the results together, boomerang, maxima, Dazier, VSA, and the CBI. And the agreement is really remarkably good. So it is pretty amazing that all the results from these four difficult experiments tie together quite so well. And of course, as you are all in this room very aware, the biggest question of all, of course, that we're all pondering about and is, why should lambda be non-zero? It's a pretty unsatisfactory situation to have most of the matter, dark matter that we know nothing about, and lambda non-zero. Okay, I've got 0 minutes left, so let me just make this final point. I just want to show you this as a lead-in to what Steve Myers is going to say about polarization observations with the CBI. So here's a prediction of the level of sensitivity we think we could get to if we could observe 100 square degree fields with 450 hours of observations on each of the fields. And the blue is the EE and the red is the cross-polarized spectrum. And let me just say that as of now, 10 of the 13 receivers have already been upgraded to switchable polarization, and 7 of them are back on the platform. And we started observing, doing astronomical calibrations with those 7 last Thursday. Thank you very much. I'll get rid of that for you.
Okay, so as Tony mentioned, our key project for the next year or two is to measure polarization with the CBI. He showed you a projection made by Wei-Li Pin and the CETA group, but we've actually, using the software that we developed to analyze produce the power spectra that you see before, we have actually upgraded that software in addition to do polarization. Now, next few minutes I'll indulge myself and get a bit technical about how interferometers measure the CMB. An interferometer essentially works in Fourier space. It measures directly in L space. In fact, measures the Fourier transform. A visibility on your firm measures the Fourier transform of the sky intensity convolved with that aperture in Fourier space, basically the size of the aperture. And as such, a given interferometer baseline measures a given L scale equal to 2 pi times that baseline in units of wavelengths. And the patch over which this Fourier space is smeared is given by the cross-correlation of the two apertures. And so the analysis that we showed those power spectra from basically worked directly on the interferometer visibilities in Fourier space. Now, in fact, the interferometers that we're talking about are actually measuring circular polarization. And when you cross-correlate two elements with the same sense of circular polarization, right or left, you're measuring this intensity I. But if you cross-correlate baselines with cross-polarized antennas, you actually measure the polarization directly. And in fact, if you cross-correlate two circular polarizations, what you pull out is this combat, essentially, like here's a right versus left, you pull out Q plus IU and this parallactic angle term. So if we look back here, put parallactic angle, because our platform for the CBI is the antennas are locked to this pointing platform, the parallactic angle is essentially this angle in UV space. If our interferometer elements were infinitely small, we would pull out Q plus IU, which you polarization aficionados will recognize as E plus IB. Now, those of you who've analyzed polarization prospects for other instruments like Planck know that if you measure a cut region in the sky, in a sense, you mix the E and B polarization. And that can be easily seen here as that the polarization, the parallactic angle, varies over this patch, but your instrument essentially measures this convolution. And this is just a Fourier representation of the cut sky problem. But as stated before, a nice thing about our interferometer is it measures this combination of Q plus IU, which you can show down here, is essentially E plus IB with these parallactic angle terms. And so this has now been coded into the gridding software and the likelihood software that we used in the papers that were recently appeared on AstroPH. And so in addition to forecasts, we can actually construct mock data sets. Again, this is roughly 400 hours. This is a single deep field, comparable to the deep field that Tony showed. This doesn't include point sources or other instrumental effects, but it shows that we can actually start to see the polarization power spectra. In other words, CBI does have the sensitivity to actually measure polarization. This is essentially the best fit model or something very close to what Tony showed. Now, what we actually plan to do is measure in some mosaic fields. Actually, we plan to measure a deep field and some mosaic fields. And this is what you would get for the polarization in such a mosaic. I think this is roughly about a 2 to 3 square degree mosaic, again about, I think, 400 hours. One thing you can see, the software can pull out the fact that there are E correlations and no B correlations put in. And this comes by looking at the statistics of those cross-polarized baselines. And we can get TT and the TE correlation also. So I think prospects are quite good for CBI. As Tony mentioned, we're tooling up the instrument itself. The software pipeline is essentially in place. We're planning to do a suite of mock data tests. One of the important things in the upgrade is actually the polarizers that are going into the instrument are much better now using John Kovacs and John Carlstrom's design, and that's going to be a fantastic benefit. So this is what we hope to be showing in the coming year, data from this. Thanks. Right, so I don't know the numbers. That was based on, we actually operated the first year of the CBI. We actually had one of the antennas cross-polarized to the other 12. The results I showed here are for 7 of one polarization and 6 of the other. And that's actually John Cartwright's thesis was talked about in Paris. I'm not sure what the numerical limits are, Tony. But yeah, but because the sensitivity is much lower, it's an upper limit on them. I think it's probably 6 microkelvin-ish level.
Are those projections just at 30 gigahertz or 20 or
90? Those are just 30 gigahertz, essentially using the same 10 bands that we've got now. Well, at least for the CMB, point sources are a particular problem. So, and also, if we want to push to higher L in the future, a 90 gigahertz upgrade would be, I think, a very nice thing to do.
Are you going to be measuring the point source's polarization properties, either at OBRO or at GreenBank as well?
Probably GreenBank would be the place to do that. Yeah. The TE, well, in this, let's see, in this mock data set, I think it's because the errors, at least at some of those error bars, are cosmic variance limited, so they're just slave to the intensity of actually the scales have changed between them greatly. If you look at these plots. So, well, these two, yeah, the scales here are about a factor or two different. So you have to be a little careful, but the significance is in percent is about the same, and I think that's cosmic variance contribution to those error bars.
There's also a difference in the ratio of sensitivity to T to E.
Yeah.
Yeah. So MAP is not going to get a single high signal to noise measurement on any of the inputs, whereas CBI anticipates having high signal to noise measurements of polarization. So your EE detection is going to be correspondingly stronger compared to your TE than your MAP detection. They're going for a smaller area of scattering.
Yeah.
Sure. But you're also going to see the T has to be smaller.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
You're still retaining the same T sensitivity.
That's right.
Relative to Q and U, right?
Yeah. Well, it goes down because we're splitting what would normally be pure TT. In the current CBI, it's getting diluted because we're devoting some, cross-polarizing the elements, and those baselines then no longer measure TT. They now measure.
But only by two.
The temperature measurements, you showed a line showing how much unknown sources would contaminate you. Do you know how much those unknown sources would contaminate your polarization?
We could make some projections. We haven't actually incorporated the source analysis into the mock data yet. You're going to say some.
What we will do is we will survey these fields with the GBT telescope, with the GBT, and so we will know exactly which sources are a problem.
I mean,
we can go after those with polarization on the GBT. So point sources with the GBT, this will not be a problem. The other thing I should have mentioned is we've only analyzed half of the CBI data so far. So that plus the combination of the fact of not having to project out all of these sources is going to improve our limits by a very large factor, substantially. But really, the point is it should not be a problem because we'll know exactly where they are.
Yeah, and these are the same fields that we're doing, so we can project the polarization part out, too.
I can't remember if you said in your talk, what are the prospects for loading your airbars out at very high L where you see the excess, and how far are you going to go on that?
We're not actually leaning on that right now because we've been concentrating on the second year of data actually only has mosaic observations, so we don't have any more deep fields. We're actually going to push out to about just a bit over 2,000 for polarization because we're concentrating all of our baselines to between, about 700 and 1,500 where you expect to get the maximum signal, and we're very well matched there. At this point, we weren't planning on really pushing, chasing after that high L detection because we think we'd probably have to sacrifice too much in the polarization observations to do that. But we should get a very much better handle on the total intensity, of course, at the same time as doing the polarization. But that will only go up a bit of a thousand, so.
Probably around 800-ish. That this is Cartwright's. But those numbers, I'm just essentially making them up off the top of my head.
But you've been recording.
Yeah, that's right.
It was 8.5.
Ah.
Okay. If there's no further questions, let's thank Steve.